Well, thank you very much for the introduction, and good morning from me as well. So I would also like to thank you for the invitation to come here today and tell you about the exciting research I've been doing over the last several years. As Luis said, the title of my talk is Probing Frontiers of Fundamental Physics and Astrophysics with Numerical Relativity. Before I move on with my talk, of course, I would like to just acknowledge my collaborators whom I've listed all, down here on the in green. And of course, I've had the pleasure to work with them and learn from them over the years, and it would be completely ignorant of me not to just put their names on this slide. So a quick outline of the talk. First, I will just try to provide some motivation, a little bit of discussion about gravitational wave sources and detection. Then I will try to give you some introduction to numerical relativity, and what are the challenges that a numerical relativist faces, and what kind of methods we've developed over the years to overcome these challenges. Okay. And then in the second half of my talk, I'll just present some results from recent magnetized neutron-star simulations. Actually, this is work that just appeared today on the archive. And then some a little bit older work on magnetized accretion onto binary black hole systems. I'll try to summarize then with some future directions that I, at least my vision for numerical relativity in the next 5 to 10 years or so. So Einstein's theory of general relativity has triumphantly withstood over 100 years of experiments. We have tests going from weak field tests in the solar system, stronger field tests like the Hulse-Taylor pulsar. We even have cosmological tests, if you believe in the Lambda CDM, of course, model for the universe. So it's been extremely successful. And of course, recently, a figure that you probably have seen 100 times already, we have the amazing confirmation that gravitational waves, as were predicted by Einstein, they do exist. This is the signal that was discovered by the LIGO detector, the GW150914. In a recent workshop, we decided that this is actually too long a name, so we would be calling it the event. So I'll be using that as well. So this is the event. And amazingly, this doesn't confirm just the existence of gravitational waves, for which we, of course, already knew that they exist from the Hulse-Taylor pulsar. Another amazing confirmation is that GR, general relativity, is completely consistent with the signal. And moreover, that this particular waveform that is reconstructed here, and this is the actual data after a bandpass filter, actually, that we're seeing, is completely consistent with the in-spiral and merger of two massive black holes of order 30 solar masses each. So this signal also provides a spectacular confirmation that black holes, or at least the best evidence so far, that black holes exist. Not just binary black holes, but even black holes, they exist. So this is the cleanest evidence that we have so far for their existence. All right, so now we have the first strong field and dynamical space-time test for general relativity. But the truth is that the strong field regime of dynamical GR essentially has just starting to be probed. And in the next few years, all of general relativity's predictions in the strong field dynamical regime, they will be put to the test. Advanced LIGO and Virgo will make routine detections of gravitational waves, not just from black hole binaries, but neutron star binaries and neutron star black hole binaries. And discussions with the members of the LIGO collaboration already hint that they will come with a press conference which will probably announce something spectacular, not just the existence of binary black holes, maybe some new type of compact binary system. And hopefully by 2020, the pulsar timing arrays, the nanograph operating in North America, will also detect gravitational waves from supermassive black holes, not just these stellar mass black holes. We also have the Event Horizon Telescope that has already started to visualize the black hole in our galaxy, and also the black hole in the galaxy M87, and Avery here is driving a lot of the work that is being done in the Event Horizon Telescope. And further down the road, we will have ELISA the new gravitational wave observatory probing a different part of the spectrum of gravitational waves. So the time ahead of us is very, very exciting. Now, at least for LIGO, and not only LIGO, for most gravitational wave observatories, the most promising sources for gravitational waves are compact binaries, that is, binaries that involve black holes or neutron stars. And the original estimates for the detections is that advanced LIGO would be detecting between 0.4 and 400 events per year, which is remarkable because with the information from the recent event, now we just for black hole binaries, we, the estimates have been a little bit tuned up, let's say, but consistent with previous estimates for 200 to 400 per year. But this number actually was originally intended to be for binary neutron stars because that's what everybody thought, that LIGO would be a binary neutron star detector, not a black hole detector. So the first surprise is already out there. We detected binary black holes and not binary neutron stars.
So what was the estimate for black hole?
It was consistent essentially with what they found. It's consistent with this range, let's say. So it ranges, but the range that was predicted, it was consistent with this.
But I mean, if every 4 hours you see an event, then it's much more than 400, isn't it?
I'm not sure I understand.
But when did you see that? I mean, after the LIGO detector turned on, how long did it take to see it?
Well, they released 16 days.
And they have a total of 30. Yeah, the data that was analyzed, it was 16 days of coincident data between the two LIGO detectors.
Okay.
So the one event is for 16 days, essentially. And then they have the trigger that they didn't call an event. And so, you know, if you consider the trigger as well, then it...
Right.
All right, so why are we interested, of course, in gravitational waves? Because gravitational waves are probes of fundamental physics, astrophysics, and cosmology. And here's an incomplete list of what we can do with gravitational waves, just to go quickly through it. Especially if we have gravitational waves and a coincident electromagnetic signal from the same source, we can test strong field gravity, and not only general relativity, but also alternative theories of gravity. We can constrain the nuclear equation of state because the unknown equation of state for neutron stars leaves a particular imprint on the gravitational waveform. And if we pick it up, then we can actually tell something about what is the state of the matter above the nuclear saturation density. We can also test dark energy models by probing the luminosity distance redshift relationship, which will be independent from standard candles because binary black holes and even neutron star binaries and black hole neutron star binaries can act as standard sirens, not standard candles. That's the usual term that is used. They can also constrain formation scenario for compact binaries. We don't really know how they form, and that's why there's all this uncertainty in the range on the rates of how these systems there's a lot of uncertainties in the physics that goes in the systems, and we can actually constrain them if we figure out what is the population of stars that are out, sorry, of neutron stars that is out there, the masses of black holes, the spins of black holes. So this is something important. We can also help, the gravitational waves can inform us where much of the heavy elements, like the R process elements, come from. It is thought today that binary neutron star mergers eject a large amount of neutron-rich matter that undergoes an R process and builds up essentially heavy elements that would not be able to be synthesized otherwise. And also, they can help unveil the progenitor or the engine that powers short gamma ray bursts, which is, these are all long-standing puzzles in astrophysics and even cosmology, of course, for the dark energy. And we can now start to probe all these. I think what is most important, at least for me, my personal taste, is that gravitational waves open a new window to the universe. And I think when things will get exciting is when we start to see signals we don't understand. Because, okay, now we have all the signals that we understand and we expect, but the most important thing is when we actually going to be surprised, and then we have to go back to the drawing board and try to understand, okay, what is this thing that LIGO saw? That will be the most exciting part, in my view. And all of this will be possible because we are on the verge of having a global network of gravitational wave observatories. We have the two LIGO detectors in the United States. There are plans for the third LIGO detector in India, which are going quite well, allegedly. Then there's the Virgo detector that hopefully will turn on by 2018. There are some problems actually with Virgo right now. It was supposed to turn on later on this year, but it's not going to happen. Apparently, and then there's also plans for the Kagura, which is also it's the cryogenic gravitational wave detector in Japan. So we're going to have a huge network of gravitational wave detectors that we'll be able to do wonderful science with. Now, gravitational waves, of course, are not easy to detect. They come with a certain set of requirements. One of the biggest problems is that the signal tends to be pretty weak, unlike this extremely loud gravitational wave event that we saw. most of the cases that we expect actually is going to be the signal will be buried in the noise. And so people have devised these wonderful techniques that are called matched filtering, essentially, where you cross-correlate the data or the noise of the detector with a known signal, and then you can extract the signal from the detector. However, this technique requires reliable theoretical gravitational waveforms in order to work. Moreover, gravitational wave interferometers have very poor angular resolution. This means that you cannot really tell the source exactly where it is on the sky. Typically, with two detectors, you just have a ring where the source is located on the sky. And if we don't really know the location of the source on the sky, that makes parameter estimation from gravitational waves a little bit more challenging. And so there's some degeneracies that arise with that. But if we had a simultaneous electromagnetic signal from the source, from the same gravitational wave source, then the good thing about gravitational waves is that they could tell us that exactly where the source is on the sky, and so we can eliminate degeneracies that arise that from the position of the source in the sky, and that facilitates parameter estimation. And also it accelerates the parameter estimation and makes it more accurate in terms of requiring fewer templates, in fact, to find what are the parameters of the system. So electromagnetic modeling of gravitational wave sources is very, very important, just from the gravitational wave science point of view. And of course, just having an orthogonal information from a particular source, from electromagnetic waves and gravitational waves, we can hope also to learn more about the source. So if we need to compute complete gravitational wave and electromagnetic signatures from plausible astrophysical sources, this requires that we solve the nonlinear Einstein equations. And I'll explain why this is the case. So I said already that, okay, most promising sources are the compact binary and spirals, but during the last stages of the compact binary and spiral, things become extremely nonlinear. We have strong field gravity, we have relativistic velocities, and all known approximations to general relativity breakdown. And the only avenue to understand what's going on in the strong field regime is to use numerical relativity. Yes?
There are formulas for the string involving the chart mass, big G, the masses, so on, and the phase.
Right.
So if you know some of it, you can model those parameters to get
waveform. Yes, but this would require essentially that you possibly see a binary neutron star, a binary black hole neutron star system, that it will be in the detector for a much, much longer time. So for example, this gravitational wave event that was detected, it would not have been possible without numerical relativity, and I'll get to that momentarily. All right, so I told you where numerical relativity is important, but I haven't told you what numerical relativity is. So I'm just going to borrow the definition from the numerical relativity textbook by Thomas Baumgart, because I like the first part of the definition they gave. The second part, I'm going to drop it and I'll complete it. So numerical relativity is the art and science of developing computer algorithms for, and I'll complete, by for solving and understanding the equations of classical relativistic gravitation in the nonlinear strong field regime. I think it's a much more encompassing definition, much more generous than the original that was given by Thomas and Stu. in fact, you know, somebody might argue that this is not even, you know, general enough. So, but I think it's a much.
So long as the original.
It just focuses on astrophysical sources alone, nothing else. All right. So you want to become yes.
Before you start about the modeling of the EM and the gravitational wave signal, you were saying that the angular resolution is quite poor.
Yes.
But if you're going to have such a large network of detectors,
it will get better. It will get better if you have more. But still, we're talking about several tens of squares or square degrees in the sky. It's not going to get much better than that.
Okay.
And so if you really wanted, say, for example, to inform some telescope, OK, now look at the sky and search for some electromagnetic counterpart, you know, the 10 square degrees or 20 square degrees on the sky is actually a pretty large area. Yeah, so, all right, so let's assume you want to become a numerical relativist. What does that entail? There are some unique challenges to numerical relativity. As I mentioned already, you need to solve the Einstein equations. These are 10 second order highly nonlinear partial differential equations, so we have to solve these. If we want to model matter and radiation, we have to solve the energy momentum and radiation transport equations. That's another 8 partial differential equations. It's as well nonlinear. If we want to have electromagnetic fields, we have to solve Maxwell's equations. That's another 8 partial differential equations. And at least we should respect Baryon number conservation. That's another PDE. And that's a total of 27 coupled nonlinear partial differential equations in 3 plus 1 dimensions. In fact, the radiation transport equation is a 6 plus 1 dimensional equation, not a 3 plus 1 dimensional equation. So this is a beast of its own. That's, you know, where we don't have a very good handle at the moment. So, and I'm not even mentioning any microphysics, lepton numbers, and things like that. All right, so this looks kind of tough. And then the natural question you're going to ask, is numerical relativity really necessary for gravitational wave detection in science? So now get to this question. I'll try to answer this by simply looking at the detection that LIGO announced for the event. All right, so figure 4 in that paper showed that if you do a generic transient search for without some numerical relativity calibrated template, then the significance of the detection cannot be more than 4.5 sigma or 4.6 sigma or something like that. So to claim the 5 sigma detection that was claimed by the LIGO and Virgo collaborations, you actually need to do a binary coalescence search. So the templates that were used, they were actually phenomenological templates, but those were calibrated from numerical relativity. In fact, not only the 5 sigma detection would not be possible if we didn't have numerical relativity solutions, but also parameter estimation would not have been possible without numerical relativity. So the answer to the question in the title of the slide is a resounding yes. Numerical relativity is absolutely necessary for gravitational wave science and not only detection, but also parameter estimation. Now, some other unique challenges about numerical relativity is that if we want to model black holes, we have something we have that we call Gignon singularities or curvature singularities, and we have to do something about them because a singularity means that things blow up and computers do not like infinities. So if we want to stably solve the Einstein equations, then we have to choose coordinates. In fact, it turns out that we need dynamical coordinates, that is, we'll build the coordinates as we solve for the space-time. And these coordinates have to evolve according to well-posed evolution equations. If you've never heard about the well-posedness of the initial value problem, you can think of it as continuous dependence on the initial data, essentially. Now, if we have black holes, then we can either do black hole excision, that is, get rid of whatever is inside the horizon so that we don't have the physical singularity on the computational domain. And at the same time, we need, of course, coordinates that avoid any coordinate singularity, so we have to be worried about that. And this was the approach that Franz Pretorius used in 2005 with the so-called generalized harmonic coordinates to solve the binary black hole problem for the first time. Another approach is to consider coordinates that avoid both coordinates and physical singularities simultaneously. This has been called by some people the excision without excision approach. And an example of these conditions is what people call the puncture gauge conditions. And these were introduced by Campanelli et al. That shortly after Franz solved the binary black hole problem, they actually came with an independent approach to solve the binary black hole problem. Perhaps you've heard the word puncture before. I'd just like to spend 2 minutes just to explain what a puncture is and what the puncture gauge coordinates do, because the puncture approach represents maybe 95% of numerical relativity today. It's much, much more easy to implement numerically, so it makes it more attractive. All right, so to explain what a puncture is, I'm just going to go back to the old Schwarzschild metric that we all know and love, and this big R is the Schwarzschild radius, and we know that in these coordinates, the horizon is at 2m. I'm adopting geometrized units where g is equal to c is equal to 1. And r is the aerial radius, essentially. And we know that in these coordinates, the physical singularity is at r equals 0. Another well-known example representation, at least, of the Schwarzschild metric is the representation in the so-called isotropic coordinates. In isotropic coordinates, we can just do a simple radial transformation. We just introduce a new radial coordinate, little r. And this psi here is given by 1 plus m over 2r. And then if you just do the transformation, you arrive at this line element for the Schwarzschild metric. And because the spatial part is isotropic, hence the name of isotropic coordinates. Now, what I can do is plot on the y-axis the Schwarzschild radius versus the new radial isotropic radius. And as you can see, that no matter what value the little r has, the aerial radius never goes below 2m, in fact. So you never actually go inside the horizon. So this is a trick, a coordinate trick, for just to map only the part of the spacetime, of the Schwarzschild spacetime, that is outside r of 2m. In other words, the curvature singularity, the r, big r equals zero, is avoided. It's never on the spacetime. This is essentially the r equals zero in these coordinates would be what numerical relativists will call the puncture, essentially. That's the idea. So similarly, the puncture gauge conditions have been shown numerically. What they do is that they map the spacetime for r, in the Schwarzschild case, for greater than 1.31m. So you do still have a little bit, you're a little bit inside the horizon still with these coordinates. And this was demonstrated numerically, and therefore these conditions are singularity avoiding. And by singularity, I mean curvature singularity here.
Can I ask you a bit more about the previous law, the big R again? Is there something more about the fact that there are two values of little r corresponding to big R?
You mean this part here?
Yeah.
Yeah, essentially this is like taking a copy of the exterior universe and having another universe essentially inside the black hole. So so this is a trick, essentially it's just changing the topology in some sense. And this topology for the black holes is called a trumpet topology because it looks like not a trumpet, actually. The trumpet would be if you had a single throat and then going up. But this would go, if you were to do an embedding of this particular spacetime, it would look something like this, essentially.
And then you are going to keep both of those regions.
Excuse me?
And you are going to keep both of those regions.
When you do the simulations, actually, this part completely disappears. When you start the simulation in the so-called puncture gaze, let's say, this inner part disappears, and eventually what it relaxes to is this. And this is what people call the trumpet topology, essentially.
Okay. Thank you. And Einstein knows a bridge that keeps pinching off. Mm-hmm. Singularity. So why is the physics of this choice not different from what you actually have? How do you know?
How do I know? Because the solution that I find is exactly the Schwarzschild solution. I mean, what do you mean? How do I know? Right. So I don't see. It's just a property. No, I mean, this is all enclosed by a horizon, right? So, I mean, the part of the spacetime that's outside the horizon doesn't care about what's going inside.
Cosmic censorship.
Yeah, I mean, it's causality, I would say, not so much cosmic censorship in this case.
Well, I think it's because you hope that the evolution doesn't expose the reason that we ignore it.
So the doesn't expose
the
what?
Evolution doesn't expose the region that you ignore.
Right, and it doesn't. And it doesn't.
Some level of faith there.
Of course, yeah, there's certainly some level of faith, no doubt. No, but it just works. We found that empirically it just works, and it's a.
Yeah, but it's not just faith. If it doesn't happen, then the code will break up and you see.
Yeah, right. Hasn't broken up. It hasn't broken yet.
No, it doesn't. It just works wonderfully in these coordinates, actually. Right.
Do you have to evolve certain boundary conditions for that? So you just evolve everything.
Yeah, so maybe something that I didn't say is that this little r is a coordinate singularity, right? So if you have a coordinate singularity, if it is on your grid, things are going to blow up. So the trick, essentially, is that to make sure that when you have your discretized grid, and these are, let's say, the grid points here that you have, is that this r equals zero is never on a grid point. And just the evolution, you know, the chances of it getting on a grid point are basically zero. So things just work. And even if you start increasing the resolution, you make the grid finer, things are fine. The truth is that inside the horizon, the solution is not accurate. In fact, we know that there are inaccuracies inside the horizon. But we're saved by causality. Things don't leak out of the horizon. So this approach just works wonderfully. That's why people have termed it excision without excision. Yes?
So on your next on the next transparency, you have 1.31. So how do you even get in these coordinates inside?
But you do go inside. It's not outside the...
Sorry, on the previous, on the coordinate...
Oh, no, you don't start with that initial, that you don't take that as an initial condition. You can start with some other more regular condition, essentially, say the ingoing Eddington-Filkenstein coordinates for Schwarzschild, and then it will relax.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
The original Schwarzschild paper is avoided having singularity number 2. The solution doesn't look like what we need to take.
Okay.
So you have different... choice for her, so it was not really more than the singularity. If you look at the original paper. So this is
I haven't seen the original paper, I admit, so I don't know exactly what it is your...
There's a vanillarizing was at what at the r equals 0.
Yeah. Oh, so it was. So you're saying it was the isotropic coordinates?
Well,
I mean, you know, I can find a million different ways of doing that. For example, I can take the usual Schwarzschild metric, right, and do a simple shift, define a new coordinate where I just shift the radial coordinate. And then I can make sure that I map only the part of the space-time which is outside the horizon. I don't have to do this particular trick. So it's with coordinates, you can do whatever you want. Okay, so, all right, well, of course, some other challenges that are not unique to numerical relativity, but even to Newtonian hydrodynamics. We have discontinuities that arise due to shocks when we evolve matter. We have colliding neutron stars. We have accretion onto black holes or binary black holes. We can have tidal or turbulent shocks that arise. And the shock basically would mean that we have an infinite gradient. So we have to do something about that. What we do, I'm not just going to go through that because this is a very extended topic, is we employ what people have used for decades in Newtonian hydrodynamics and magnetohydrodynamics. We employ high-resolution shock capturing schemes that are based on what is called the finite volume approach, and that another jargon that is used is Riemann solvers. All you need to care about is that shocks are really captured automatically in this approach, and we don't really have to worry about that. We also have a very large dynamic range. We have length scales that go from, let's say, 0.1 kilometers, so we have to resolve at least, you know, the radius of the star or the horizon, if we're talking about a stellar mass black hole, all the way out to the wave zone. We have order, essentially, 3, 4, 5 orders of magnitude, depending on what the problem is. The timescales are actually what's killing us for the most part, because we have to resolve the light crossing time or the dynamical time of the neutron star if we're evolving. And we have to evolve for a few orbital periods if we want to be able to compute several cycles of gravitational waves. So we have about 5 orders of magnitude of timescales involved in this problem. Typically, what we do is to employ adaptive mesh refinement, where we essentially focus resolution only where it's necessary, and then evolve the parts of the space-time that are not very dynamic or high velocity with low resolution. But even with adaptive mesh refinement, typical computations require between 1 to 4 months, and I've run simulations for 9 months, in fact, the longest simulations I've ever done. Now, there are also some other issues, what I will call here electromagnetic gauge issues. When we evolve magnetized fluids in the so-called ideal magnetohydrodynamics approximation, that is the limit where the conductivity of the plasma is infinite, then what we have to do is we essentially get Maxwell's equations in this limit that are casted in this particular form. On the left, I have the general relativity equations. On the right, I have the Minkowski space-time analog. Yes?
Is that actually consistent with relativity to set the conductivity to infinity?
Yeah, why not?
Because, I mean, then that means they have instantaneous reaction to electric field, so... if you say turn on some electric field, it takes some time for the current to turn on, and I don't know, I guess I was under this impression that ideal MHD is not...
Ideal MHD is perfectly hyperbolic. There's no issue with any...
Okay.
I mean, the equations are... There's nothing that propagates at an infinite speed in ideal magnetohydrodynamics.
But that's not the limit. Okay, so... So I suppose, I guess the thing is, so there's a Biermann battery, which is what you...
Oh, Biermann battery, that pertains to different physics, in fact.
Yes. Well, okay. That's fine.
All right, so So for the rest of the presentation, I'll just focus on the Minkowski spacetime because I think it's more transparent for what I'll talk about. The only thing that we need to worry is that we need to enforce the so-called divergence constraint, which would be the DIV-B constraint in flat spacetime. And that's because if it's not zero, we generate monopoles. And there are a few different ways you can enforce it. One is typically known, for example, as divergence cleaning, which is what Luis is typically adopting, so just to have some control over it. And it turns out that for uniformly spaced grids, there are very nice methods from Newtonian magnetohydrodynamics that people can use. But in adaptive mesh refinement, where we have, say, here's a star which could be magnetized here, and we have boxes, nested boxes, where we have higher resolution and lower resolution as we move outward, it's not easy to respect this constraint. And the reason is because we need to communicate information between these different levels of the different resolution, and then essentially, we have to perform interpolations at these adaptive mesh refinement boundaries. And this typically, if you don't choose your interpolation smartly, it will introduce magnetic monopoles. So that's the simple explanation behind it, essentially.
Just to check, by gauge issues here, you mean evolution which preserves physical constraint, not actually electromagnetic gauges?
It's electromagnetic gauges, and I will get to it very quickly.
Okay, that's a separate issue from this one, then.
This is a separate issue from this one. This might be a little bit misleading. It will become clear in the next slide. So there are methods, actually, even for adaptive mesh refinement to completely enforce this constraint. But they tend to be quite elaborate and not too trivial to implement. So what my collaborators and I instead thought about is essentially to adopt a vector potential formulation. So we have a four-vector potential. Now the gauge issues that I mentioned will become clear. Now we have the B field is given by the curl of the spatial part of the four-vector potential, and the induction equation that we need to solve turns into this equation. So you can convince yourselves, if you take the divergence of B, the divergence of the curl is zero, so you have divergenceless magnetic field. If you take the curl of this equation, the curl of the gradient of phi is identically zero, so you recover the induction equation exactly as you should expect. However, the benefit of this approach is that now, since we're evolving a vector potential, we can perform any interpolation across the adaptive mesh refinement boundary, or at least naively one would think that there's no issue. We should be able to do that and then maintain the divergence of the constraint, but we must make a gauge choice. So the simplest possible thing, one could say, well, why keep this thing here? Let's just choose phi equals to constant, just some algebraic gauge condition, get rid of it, and then we solve just three equations instead of having some evolution equation for phi, and now we just need to solve this induction equation where the B field, of course, will be replaced by the curl of A in this equation so that it's just three equations that we need to evolve. But now, before you just implement something, you should always try to understand it analytically, and here's one easy thing in usual analysis to perform what we call an eigenmode analysis, where all you have to do is just impose small amplitude harmonic perturbations, and that means is equivalent to replacing the Nabla operator here by a wave vector of unit norm. And if you do this, then you recover essentially an eigenvalue problem. So this matrix M is called the characteristic matrix for this particular system. And you can find the eigenvalues of this matrix. And what you will recover is that you have two non-zero modes. These are the advection modes. So this two essentially say that the perturbation you're imposing has to be advected with the velocity. That's what it is. And this is exactly the induction equation. The induction equation is a transport equation. It tells us how the magnetic field is transported with a fluid, essentially, with the plasma. And then we have a zero speed mode here that you will soon realize that it turns out to be a gauge mode. And that's why all these issues with the gauges here. All right, and now you can say, okay, we have this gauge. Now things should work just fine. And let's just look at what happens if we evolve a magnetized binary black hole in this algebraic gauge. So what I'm going to show you now is a movie of a black hole with a neutron star where the magnetic field is initially confined completely in the interior of the neutron star. And this is contours of the A field squared of the spatial part of the vector potential. And this is just contours on the equatorial plane. So I'm going to let it evolve, but before I say I let it evolve, ideal magnetohydrodynamics means that, again, the magnetic field must be advected with the fluid. So what you would expect is that if I have magnetic field completely confined to the neutron star and the neutron star starts to move, the magnetic field should follow the neutron star. That's what ideal magnetohydrodynamics means. And so I'm going to let it evolve and pause it very quickly. And already you start to see that something bizarre happens. You see that we don't have the leading edge, essentially, is where the neutron star is. But the vector potential doesn't track the motion of the neutron star. There's a trail of A field left behind. And you would say, did we expect that? And the answer is yes, because I told you that the system actually has a zero speed mode. A zero speed mode means that it doesn't propagate. When I enter my initial data, I haven't made sure that I don't have gauge modes in my initial data. So if I have a gauge mode, it stays there. And as it propagates, I'm still going to have gauge modes in my solutions. And this is why I have a trail left behind the neutron star. So I'm going to let it evolve. And I'll remind you essentially that we have a nested box of refinement levels, around the neutron star. So eventually you get all that mess that I showed you, and you would say, okay, fine, but you didn't show us a physical variable, you showed us a gauge variable, and you're right. And so what happens if we look at the magnetic energy density, which is a physical quantity? So this is a movie of the same system, but I'm showing the magnetic energy density. So you see that soon after the neutron star starts, you do have advection of the magnetic field with the neutron star, but there's a lot of spurious stuff left behind. And now what is that? The reason is that I remind you that the neutron star carries a set of refinement boxes around it. And across these refinement boxes, we have to perform interpolations to carry information from higher resolution to lower resolution. But I never designed an interpolation scheme that converts a gauge mode into a gauge mode and a physical mode into a physical mode. So this scheme essentially converts gauge modes into physical modes. So I get spurious magnetic field, physical magnetic field, but it shouldn't be there because the gauge choice I made is incorrect. I'm going to let it evolve, and eventually you won't even be able to distinguish what's a neutron star and what is mess. And you can even see the refinement boxes essentially that are around. Okay, so you would say, okay, this is really bad. It shouldn't be how things should behave. So what can we do? Well, the algebraic gates turned out to be a bad choice. How about if we change the gates? And then you can choose the Lorentz gates that we all know and love, which is the divergence of the four vector potentials should be zero. That provides me an evolution equation for phi now. And I have to couple it in the induction equation. I can perform the eigenmode analysis I mentioned earlier. And then what I'll find is that the characteristic matrix of this system, actually, the zero speed mode has actually turned into a propagating mode. And now you can understand why that mode was a gauge mode, because I changed the gauge and the speed changed. And of course, we have the physical modes that should be intact. So this mode now, because I'm assuming geometry as units, these actually is a wave traveling to the left at the speed of light and a wave traveling to the right at the speed of light. So that's the physical interpretation. All right, so what happens if we now evolve, in this case, in the Lorentz gauge? So I'm just going to start in a very quickly stop it. Here you see now that soon after the star begins to orbit, there's a burst of A field that is emitted away. This is essentially the gauge modes that are present in my initial data, and now they propagate at the speed of light, so they leave the computational domain. Okay, so now I'm going to let it evolve, and you can see that even the vector potential is affected with the neutron star, as you would hope to see. And so now the question is, what happens to the physical variable? You will see that the spurious magnetic field generation is much reduced. You have this better advection of the magnetic field. But there's still some a little bit spurious stuff left. And then is there anything we can do better to remove that? The answer is yes. In order to perform long-term and stable simulations of these kind of systems, you have to change the gauge yet again. So what I did was to introduce this generalized Lorentz gauge. In which we, in fact, set the divergence of the A field equal to some source function. And if you choose a source function in a proper way, which is, I use here, minus psi phi, then I have the modified equation for the vector potential. And of course, I can do, again, the eigenmode analysis. And if you find the eigenvalues, what you'll see is that the eigenvalues now have an imaginary part, which is strictly non-positive, which means that these modes are actually damped traveling gauge waves. So not only the waves propagate away, but they're also being damped at the same time. And the strength of the damping is regulated by this psi factor. And this is essentially the key ingredient that made possible all the simulations that I will be talking about later. It's to run long-term simulations in this approach, this is what you need to do.
So, but in this case, there is a constraint how much damping you can set.
It's a numerical constraint. There's no constraint in how much nabbing you can add.
But in some sense, it's also physical, right? It depends on k. So depending what.
It's only the k equals zero that actually this cannot cannot damp. That's the but any other mode is being damped.
And we're thinking the largest error would be the higher modes.
Right.
Those are the ones that are most clearly accounted for. And so yes, you're dissipating a different
rates.
Strength, different modes.
But yeah.
You're dissipating more the ones that are actually the more relevant ones.
There are also other gauges, Coulomb gauges.
The Coulomb gauge would be similar because it's basically the gradient.
Let's get the same ones.
It would not work. It would have a similar. It would have a zero speed mode actually. The Coulomb gauge.
Okay. Maxwell's equations are very complicated.
Oh, but that's because it's a, you're considering Maxwell's equations in the analytic limit. This is not analytic. So, in fact, even the spatial the algebraic gauge I talked about. If I were to take the infinite resolution limit, things should work, but we don't have infinite resolution, and that's what makes causes all the problems. So this is a combination of the properties of the equations at the analytic level and the fact that we have truncation error in our simulations.
How do you know that this solution?
Convergence. Convergence, that's the only way. You have to do convergence studies. Yeah, well, the approach should be gauge invariant. Yes, so essentially you have to choose different gauges and perform convergence studies and get the same answer with different gauges. As you do a resolution study. Yes, it has been done in the context of this gauge and the Lorentz gauge, essentially, where this would be equal to zero. And the other approach is not really possible at the resolutions we can afford right now. You will always get that spurious magnetic fields. And I should mention that, you know, if there's no, if the resolution is uniform, we don't have these interpolations to do, this works perfectly no matter what gauge you choose. There's no constraint in that case. It's only when you have adaptive mesh refinement that there's an issue. Yes?
So this might have been implicitly answered, but I'll ask anyway. Is there some optimum choice in psi?
as high as it gets. So typically we're limited, actually, that it will limit the time step that we can actually take in a simulation. So if you do a stability analysis for the numerical scheme, what you'll find is that roughly speaking, delta t, the time step, should be less than 1.5 divided by delta x. Sorry, psi delta t should be, let me think. There's no delta x. So delta t should be less than 1.5 or over psi. In other words, if I choose a very large value for psi, I will have to make my time step very, very small. So there's a trade-off between how large you can do it, you can go for psi, and how big a time step you can get. But there are approaches actually that can even overcome this problem. For example, Luis is using IMEX method, implicit-explicit methods, to overcome some of the stiffness issues that arise in the equations that he's solving in resistive magnetohydrodynamics, for example. So it's a matter of the numerical implementation and how you choose to do things. All right, so in the very little time I have left, I'm going to try to quickly go through some applications. First thing I'm going to tell you about some fresh simulations that we did, and it pertains to neutron-neutron binaries as short-hard gamma-ray burst engines. Just a quick overview of gamma-ray bursts in a nutshell. These are flashes of gamma rays that are of extragalactic origin. They're detected by multiple instruments that, of course, detect gamma rays, and they have afterglows as well, and have been detected by Hubble and in the optical, and we also have radio signatures from these events. The time scales for short gamma ray bursts are less than 2 seconds. This T90 is the time by which we have 90% of the counts in the detector, essentially, and the average T90 for gamma ray bursts is about 0.2 seconds. The typical gamma ray luminosities range between 10 to the 50 to 10 to the 52 arcs per second. The host galaxies for these systems have been identified to be spirals and gas depleted ellipticals, which points to an old evolved population of stars. And therefore, this means that it would be consistent with the merger of a binary black hole neutron star or a neutron star neutron star binary. The popular model that is considered to at least be the best for now is the relativistic jet or the fireball model, where you have an expanding relativistic jet Lorentz factor is greater than or equal to 100, and this is what explains the phenomenology at least. The plausible engine for this jet is a black hole with an accretion disk. And the progenitor is thought to be either a neutron-neutron star binary or a black hole neutron star binary. So here's the depiction, essentially, of what these things look like. You have a black hole down here with an accretion disk. There's a jet that emerges from the system. And then the prompt gamma ray emission is thought to occur by colliding shocks, essentially, inside the jet. And the afterglow emission is thought to arise when the jet actually starts to plow through the interstellar medium. And that's where all the other X-rays, gamma rays, optical afterglow emission is generated. So the, as I already said, the merger of neutron stars is one very impossible, plausible progenitor for these things. So the setting is the following. You have a neutron star system. It's massive enough that following merger, actually, the equation of state, the pressure cannot support the star, and then it collapses to form a black hole. That leads to a magnetized accretion disk around the system, and that can drive a relativistic jet, or at least that's one way. It's important to simulate and to understand, because if from a theoretical standpoint, neutron stars cannot launch jets, then we have to resort to other progenitor systems. So if I can prove theoretically somehow that this cannot happen, then these are not good progenitor systems. On the other hand, if they do launch jets, we can learn more about the source if we have a good model for how these jets arise. And moreover, the time lag between the peak gravitational waves and the jet or gamma ray prompt emission that arises from the systems can better inform gravitational wave searches that are triggered by detections in gamma rays. So, and right now, we don't really know if indeed these are the systems that power the gamma ray bursts. We don't know what's the time difference between the merger and when the jet arises or prompt gamma ray emission arises. So that's something that we could hope to learn with from simulating. And to date, there's no simulation in full general relativity that to demonstrate that there are collimated outflows, which would, what we'd call a jet, are possible for such mergers of neutron stars and the prompt black hole formation. There's one work by Rizzola et al., which claimed that jet-like structures are possible. And by jet-like, I have it in quotes because they don't really get jets. In fact, they don't have collimated outflow. They have more of an isotropic outflow in their simulations. Another recent, more recent study by Kyuchi, the Kyoto group, essentially employing higher resolution, finds that there's no outflow. This is the final configuration. There's no outflow whatsoever.
Is the idea that you form a black hole as a result of a merger?
Mm-hmm.
But then there are simulations of accretion to black holes at least.
Yes, but you have to make assumptions already about what the magnetic field looks like. All the simulations that lead to jets in single accretion accretion onto a single black hole, they assume that the initial magnetic field in the torus is actually something that I'm going to show earlier as well. It's nice loops. And this is a key for actually launching jets. But in a merger, things are going to be way more messy than starting with something like this. And it's not clear that starting with a in fact, we know from simulations on single accretion disks that if you were to start, let's say, with a purely toroidal magnetic field, you don't get a jet. It's impossible. It's only if you accrete poloidal magnetic flux on the black hole can you get a jet.
But I mean, when you start accreting, the magnetic rotational instability turns on and then makes, I guess, generate.
Yes, but you need to have a net poloidal flux. The magnetorotational instability is not going to generate a net poloidal magnetic flux. It's going to create some poloidal, but it's going to be quite turbulent in general. So it's not going to be something that a nice, interesting study by Beckwith et al. Actually is the following. They took a single accretion disk, and they did something like this. They consider a magnetic field which has loops that are like this. This goes like this, and this goes like this. When you accrete this part of the matter on the black hole, you get a jet. When this part of the matter approaches the black hole, and then you have an opposing magnetic field, actually that shuts down the jet. And in a merger event, you're going to have something pretty messy in general. You don't know a priori how things work.
But in general, not even a merger event, you're going to have a messy magnetic field. So.
Right, so you have to start with something more realistic than just this. That's what I'm trying to say here, and you know that's what these studies are trying to do and what also I'm trying to do.
Those MHC simulations, they start off with very, very weak
Yes.
You know, certainly ordered in the way you described, but very neat field.
Yes.
And so I thought the story was that those amplify and then the black hole selectively accretes one flux, or one sign.
Well, certainly there are counterexamples to what you just said. There's a 2008 paper by Chris Beckwith et al. Who've shown that changing the topology of the initial weak magnetic field makes a huge difference on whether you're going to get a jet or not. And you know, maybe also you know, another example that kind of points to that direction as well is these MAD accretion flows that McKinney and Tchaikovsky have studied, where they show that the outcome, the strength of the jet that arises, depends strongly on how much poloidal magnetic flux you're accreting. So by changing the amount of the poloidal flux can make a big difference of whether not only you get a jet, but also how strong the jet is going to be.
Are you suggesting in those matters also you need an order?
Yes,
poloidal?
Always. If you don't have an order poloidal magnetic field, things are extremely difficult. Yeah. Right. And so the question is, I'm not saying, you know, that things are not going to develop and develop a jet. In fact, I'm going to just point to the opposite direction. But you have to check that. That's what I'm trying to say. So there've been now three recent important developments for neutron stars. There's a study by Zrake and McFadgen who argued that if you have a binary neutron star merger that actually creates a shearing layer during the merger, that becomes Kelvin-Helmholtz unstable. This was actually demonstrated in Newtonian physics early on and by Anderson and Luis and collaborators, essentially, in general relativity later on. And this, but what Zrake and McFadgen said is that this will lead to turbulent mixing, and this will generate essentially a dynamo effect which amplifies the magnetic fields. And they did some local simulations, and they find that the magnetic fields can be amplified to 10 to the 16th Gauss in 1 millisecond. So that's an extremely short time scale, because it's essentially it's the time scale of the collision of the two stars. And so if you can really generate such huge magnetic fields, then you can hope to actually overcome the inertia of the matter and blow out a jet or something like that. Luis has also studied that with a subgrid model, which incorporates some of the physics that was essentially pointed out in this paper, and it shows that this indeed works. But however, the reason why you would need a subgrid model is that what was concluded in this paper is that to capture this effect, you really need about 10 to 20 times the resolutions we use in typical neutron star merger simulations today. And the other important development in this is that recently there have been studies by the Kyoto Group where they do simulations of magnetized binary neutron stars with resolutions that are about 2 to 3 times less than what is necessary to capture this event. And what they find that as they increase the resolution, the magnetic field that it builds through this effect, and it saturates to values that approach this value, this 10 to the 16 Gauss. In fact, however, they do it for 5 milliseconds because you cannot really evolve with such high resolutions for much, much longer. So this is really limited. And but it seems to confirm the expectations by Zrake and McFadgen. Now, another recent development is that my collaborators and I have been able to demonstrate that launch of jets can occur in black hole neutron star mergers. The requirement that we found was that all we have to do is actually endow the initial neutron star with an exterior magnetic field. I forgot to mention that all these previous studies actually consider magnetic fields that are confined to the interior. The reason is because using an ideal magnetohydrodynamics code to evolve the exterior magnetic fields is actually extremely challenging. And so I pushed the limits of our code by using essentially a trick in some sense. I didn't modify the equations, just modified the initial atmosphere that we have in the exterior to model these exterior magnetic fields with an ideal magnetohydrodynamics code. And once you do this, it turns out that about 100 milliseconds later, we did get a nice barber pole structure and an outflow from this system. So, if we had started with an interior magnetic field, we were completely unable, no matter what we tried, to get a jet out of these simulations.
So how big a magnetic field do you
have? This is actually a pretty strong magnetic field. It's magnetar strength-like. This was essentially a proof of principle, because if you start with the same magnetic field strength, but it's just in the interior, you don't get a jet. So the question is, if you start with the same strength, but you have an exterior, do you get a jet? So this is a proof of principle. But I have some other simulations that are running at the moment where I have a weaker magnetic field by two orders of magnitude. But I'm bound to use much higher resolution, because in the post-merger disk that forms, in order to resolve the magneto-rotational instability, I need to have much higher resolution for such weak magnetic fields. But they already confirm, essentially, the picture that I get here. And of course, the future is to go even weaker magnetic fields and confirm this picture, but at least it seems to be consistent right now.
How does the nature of that change if you add that lambda magnetic field?
It's similar. The structure is similar. The thing that changes is the time scale at which this thing emerges. It takes longer the weaker the initial magnetic field. At least, you know, at the resolutions that I can afford right now. Maybe in the future, when we can afford much higher resolutions, things will be different. All right, so the time scale essentially is for this jet in the black hole neutron star simulations is about 100 milliseconds. And if we were to evolve these neutron star systems for 40 or 50 milliseconds at the resolutions that were adopted by the Kyoto group, that would take years of simulations. So strictly speaking, we cannot really solve this problem with sufficiently high resolution and weak initial magnetic fields that we can capture the growth through this Kelvin-Helmholtz-induced growth of the magnetic field. So this is not practical. And can we do then something? So what I thought about was the following. So we already know that these simulations that have been done demonstrate that this mechanism for the growth of the magnetic field seems to work. So what if we start with strong initial magnetic fields such that in the merger remnant that forms, the magnetic field is already of that strength, of order 10 to the 16 Gauss, essentially. Is it possible to get a jet? So that's the project that I started. In this case, I used actually the initial data, the same as in the Rezzola et al. Paper that I told you earlier about, which is equal mass, n equals 1 polytropes, irrotational means non-spinning neutron star, roughly, total mass of 3.25 solar masses. The initial magnetic field is a dipolar that extends from the interior to the exterior using similar methods to what I used in the black hole neutron star case. It's dynamically weak, which means that the magnetic pressure to the gas pressure in the star is less than 0.3%. So you expect that things would scale with the magnetic field strength because it's dynamically unimportant. And following the merger, it turns out that the RMS B field in the hypermassive neutron star that forms, we call it hypermassive because it actually supports much more mass than you would be able to support if you had a uniformly rotating object, it's of order 10 to the 16 Gauss.
You have the mass of the neutron star 3.25.
Yes.
The biggest we've seen is the...
Oh, this is for both. This is the total mass. It's the sum. It's two neutron stars. It's not one.
So what is after the merger, what does the ratio rise to P mag over P gas? Is that
it's consistent. There's a little bit of amplification in certain regimes where it was weak initially. So it actually ranges between the inverse between 100 to 1,000. So this would be 1% to 0.1% to 1%.
So it doesn't go up much.
No, but because we already that's the essence of the study. We start with magnetic fields that are basically saturated after merger. You cannot build them up. The matter cannot support much larger magnetic fields. That's the idea.
Why doesn't it support much longer magnetic fields?
Because if it's much larger, essentially it's going to disrupt the star. That's one thing. You're going to have, to really disrupt the star, you need about 10 to the 18 Gauss, actually, for these. But the growth of the magnetic field is actually due to the differential rotation. So it actually drains energy from a differential rotation. So that's what sets the limit. Mm-hmm. It's the kinetic energy from the differential rotation. And it saturates it around these values.
Okay.
All right, so here's the configuration that we start out with. Two aligned dipoles. This is what it looks like near merger. To convert the time unit from units of m that we like in numerical relativity, you can use this dictionary, 15 milliseconds, about 1,000 m. for the system. And the scale, which is indicated by this black line on each snapshot, is you can use that 2m is about 9 kilometers and 26m it's about 117 kilometers. So this is the point where we form a black hole. It collapses to form a black hole. And this is 4,000m later, about 60 milliseconds later, essentially, where we develop, a nice outflow. These are the velocity arrows that point outward and we have this incipient jet. It's not a fully developed jet. It's an incipient jet. So the some numbers now from the simulations, the maximum magnetization, it's nascent. It's just started. You know, it's not really the reason why I call it incipient because it's not a Lorentz factor 100 jet. The Lorentz factor is about 1.2. It's very, very low. But the expectation is that these jets do not attain Lorentz factors at the scales that we're actually simulating right now. They achieve them at much, much higher heights from the black hole. However, the maximum magnetization in the outflow is of order 100. And steady-state axisymmetric studies of jets in special relativity have shown that this ratio is actually equal to the terminal Lorentz factor. Essentially, you convert magnetic energy to kinetic energy, and this ratio tells you what the terminal Lorentz factor is going to be. So in principle, these solutions could be accelerated to such high Lorentz factors. The disk lifetime, we can compute it by taking the mass of the disk divided by the accretion rate, turns out to be of order 0.1 seconds. So the fuel of the engine will be depleted in 0.1 seconds, which is consistent with a very short gamma ray bursts. The energy in electromagnetic fields that we get is of order 10 to the 51 ergs per second, which is also consistent with typical short gamma ray burst values. So what the simulation seemed to confirm is that neutron star mergers are viable short gamma ray burst engines as long as magnetic fields can be amplified in the remnant. In fact, with a little bit different study in the paper, we find that it should be 10 to the 15.7. That's the lower limit that we actually got. We didn't start with even lower magnetic fields, but that's the caveat here. All right, so I'm not sure I have time to go through the... It's because of all the questions, I think I'm a little bit over my...
5 minutes.
Okay, I can try to quickly go through it. All right, so we have binary black hole mergers in gaseous environments. Why are they interesting? Because we know that every galaxy core harbors, or at least we think that it harbors, a supermassive black hole. And we do observe that galaxies merge, as you can see in these nice Hubble Space Telescope image. And therefore, bound black hole binaries can form in principle at the centers of these galaxies and surrounded by a rich gaseous disk. The gravitational wave signal for black hole binaries in vacuum is a very well understood problem. It's under control. We haven't really explored the entire parameter space, but it is under control. However, studies of black holes in such gaseous environments are completely in their infancy. And the goal, again, is the holy grail of multi-messenger astrophysics, is to identify electromagnetic signatures and gravitational wave signatures from these events. This involves magnetohydrodynamic accretion onto in-spiraling and merging black hole binaries, which is an intrinsically general relativistic problem. We already have about a dozen candidates of accreting supermassive black holes. Most notably, last year, about a year and a half ago, because people made quite a bit of fuss about this PSO J334-2028+01, which they found some periodicities in the light curves of this particular quasar with a period of about 177 days. So if you turn that into a binary black hole orbital period, that would indicate that the binary actually is at subparsec separations, and it's already in the gravitational wave-driven regime, and in fact that it would merge in 20 years. So if you believe that, you know, of course, you know, it depends on everybody's taste, but you know, this is what they believe in. The mass of the black hole binary is 10 to the 10 solar masses, basically. And of course, we expect more candidates to be detected as transient surveys essentially come online, LSST, PanSTARRS, WFIRST. There's a zoo of transient surveys. And now it is important, this problem is very, very important because it involves accretion onto binary supermassive black holes and can tell us a couple of different things. It can probe strong field gravitation. These are sources for the pulsar timing arrays. It can also determine through the Hubble constant by probing the luminosity distance redshift relationship. These are very, very far away, very large redshifts. And it can also explain what people call the X-shaped radio sources. Let me just tell you a little bit about it. This is an idea that was proposed by David Merritt in 2002, and it involves something that is called the spin flip. This is an image of a X-shaped radio galaxy. So it looks like it has two jets, one that is going in this direction and one that's going this direction. Sorry, two twin jets and another set of two twin jets that are going in this direction. You might say, How is that possible? How could something like this form? And so the theory that was proposed is that if you have a black hole binary, where the black hole, let's say, is spinning in this direction, people assume that the outflow, the jets, will be aligned with the spin of the primary black hole, since it's going to be quite a bit bigger than this one. So the jet will be in this direction and in this direction before merger. However, the orbital angular momentum of the binary points in this direction. Okay, and so when you're near the innermost stable orbit, essentially, past that point, total angular momentum is approximately conserved. So the total angular momentum of the binary, in fact, points in this direction. So after merger, the binary black hole, the final binary black hole, will have a spin in this direction. That's actually, it's a known effect. It's called a spin flip. And then you could actually reorient the direction of the jet. So this is what people think is happening. You go from this to this. This is the main idea behind it. And this is something we can actually simulate. We have the tools to do that and see whether indeed it happens. So another thing is that these systems can also explain periodicities in the light curves of some quasars, so and help understand the formation and evolution of supermassive black holes. This is a big unsolved problem in astrophysics, how these supermassive black holes attain 10 to the 9 solar masses by a redshift, cosmological redshift of 6. So it's a big problem. So now here's the setting. We have a magnetized disk, which means that it's unstable to the magnetorotational instability, which has already been mentioned. If you don't know what it is, ask me at the end. I'll tell you. This drives magnetohydrodynamic turbulence that acts as viscosity and allows accretion to proceed by transport of angular momentum, essentially. The disk structure then is determined by the interplay between the viscous torques and the binary tidal torques. Viscosity drives matter inward, and tidal torques drive the matter away from the orbit. That's what the binary is doing. And the evolution turns out to have two regimes, the pre-decoupling regime, where the gravitational wave timescale is much, much longer than the viscous timescale, and the post-decoupling regime, where the gravitational wave timescale is much, much shorter than the viscous timescale. So the binary runs away from the disk, and the disk lives behind, remains behind. And if you equate the gravitational wave timescale and viscous timescale for some parameters that are characteristic to the system, you can see that for 10 to the 6 solar mass black holes, this is about a quarter of an AU, just to get a feeling for where these binaries are. So this is some early work. It was found by Lubo and Hsu, essentially, that if you start with a disk around a binary, basically the binary clears a gap. And that was the picture that everybody thought. So this leads to diminished accretion, so possibly low chances of generating electromagnetic signals. However, Luis came in 2010 and told us, well, if you actually have a magnetic field that is anchored onto a disk far away from the binary, then you can actually have some chances to generate the electromagnetic signals, even if there is a gap. But the question then is, these are actually 2D thin disks. What happens if we consider 3D dimensional thick disks in this case? So we performed simulations with a binary black hole and a disk with the usual loop structure that everybody assumes in single accretion black holes. This disk would be an equilibrium disk around the single black hole, which would have the same mass as the binary here. These are non-spinning black holes. And we let it evolve and let it relax. And eventually, you see that there are dense streams, actually, that form if we allow for magnetic fields in these simulations. And there's actually no gap. There's no cavity in there. In fact, if you look at the accretion rate and you normalize it to the accretion rate of a single black hole with the same disk, it turns out to be pretty much the same in the pre-decoupling regime here. And in the post-decoupling regime, it diminishes because the binary runs away, but it's still significant. So really, you always have accretion, which means that you can actually have pretty high hopes of generating electromagnetic signals. It turns out that we also have some outgoing flows that carry away pointing flux. And one smoking gun signature we found is that the measures of the energy, outgoing energy that we have, actually peak after the merger takes place. So that's an event that arises. And here is how this, oh, great. Yeah, I'm just going to have to just show this. Basically, this is the outflow that develops in the pre-decoupling regime. As the binary black hole merger takes place, this becomes actually even more relativistic in the end. All right, so since I'm way out of time, let me just go to my summary slide. So I hope I've convinced you that numerical relativity has come of age and is of paramount importance for LIGO science and relativistic astrophysics. We can now perform reliable simulations in full general relativity of black hole systems in vacuum and around magnetized disks. We can also do the same for black hole neutron star and neutron star in spiral. And in the future, we will be able to predict reliable electromagnetic and even neutrino signals from these sources, model the short gamma ray burst engines, tell observers how to distinguish binary from single black hole or active galactic nuclei, use numerical relativity to probe modified gravity theories, and even something I didn't have a little bit time to say, also probe alternatives to inflation. So I'll just stop here. So thank you very much for your attention.
You were talking about supermassive black hole binaries, but in stellar mass black hole binaries, there's no chance for some gas to be left around.
Well, there are some theories that people have made that if you have a binary black hole system somehow deep in a globular cluster or some cluster, not necessarily a globular cluster, then winds from Wolf-Rayet stars, for example, could actually somehow be captured around the binary, and you might have some chance of having gas around a binary, which is a stellar mass.
It was in the actual star that it goes away quickly from the stars that form black holes.
Well, the idea is that if you have a large population of such stars around there, that they will keep replenishing the matter in that area. So,
what's the time scale to get rid of gas if it's not replenished?
Well, it would depend on the details of the accretion physics. It's not something that, there's no fixed number. It will depend on whether you're hyper-Eddington, super-Eddington, or sub-Eddington accretion flows.
So why do you have to replenish it if it could be long?
Why do you have to replenish it?
It's the time scale of getting rid of gas.
Well, because if you make the assumption that this comes from Wolf-Rayet stars, the Wolf-Rayet stars are there, they will keep just sending matter. Why would they automatically stop, just sending matter there unless they somehow disappeared? So that's why I talk about replenishing matter.
So there could be an electromagnetic signal.
I cannot exclude the possibility. There were some wild scenarios that were proposed by several people after the claimed detection by the Fermi GBM detector that was allegedly a counterpart to the gravitational wave signal. But, whether you believe those scenarios or not, it's up to you.
Bring you back to the project gauge commission. Regular metrics published by James Martin and Hayward. But they're not solutions of Einstein's field equation. So also alternative gravity and a regular solution to the horizons. Of course it's not GR.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question arises, somehow remove the singularity.
Mm-hmm.
You've not seen the Einstein's theory. You can read the papers from
it. He's not removing the singularity. He's not removing the singularity. He's just not running into it. He's going to the other side of the crucible die.
Yeah.
It's just into a whole hole of fire.
It's just that the lattice is crossing that. The singularity is sitting between the lattice points. So you just never actually see it.
Right. It's not mapped into the space, and you're mapping a different part of the space time, essentially.
So there, any other questions?
I can ask a very short question, though. So in your black hole or neutron star neutron star simulation, what is the primary cooling mechanism?
In these simulations? So that's a good question, actually. So in these simulations with the binary black holes, we follow two opposite extremes. One is essentially to just have no cooling at all, and the other was to assume that you have some kind of extreme cooling that radiates any excess heat essentially immediately from the system. And so we developed an artificial cooling scheme that achieves that. It's not really realistic. And so the hope is that you can actually bracket the realistic solution between these two opposite regimes. But the answers eventually don't vary a lot. You get comparable answers, whether
but
you go to the extreme cooling.
Expect neutrino cooling, right?
Oh, no, not for these systems, no. Neutrino cooling would be more relevant to black hole neutron star mergers.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, I thought you mentioned binary black hole mergers,
no,
sorry.
No, neutrino star mergers.
Right, so in those simulations, actually, there's no cooling, there's no neutrino physics involved, actually. So that's something that is for the future, and you know.
But then how do you get accretion without
it? You don't need accretion. You have magnetic fields, the magneto-rotational instability.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's thank Vasilis again.